You then left to go to BNP. Is that right? Or was that... Because obviously I found a clipping which we'll put in, which says Barbara Noakes goes to AMV.
Oh, yes, I was going to go there.
Yeah, it says they're all very excited. It was through Peter Mead.
Yeah.
And
well, Peter Mead was in...
Very
in
early days, senior writer at Abbott Mead.
Mm. Peter Mead was... I wish I'd worked at Dodd & Burnbach. I really do.
Abbott Mead.
Sorry, Abbott Mead.
Abbott
yeah. Mead.
Did you know David Abbott? You must have bumped
into him.
Not
very well.
Yeah.
And he was quite guarded with me. Again, I was the only woman.
Yeah.
It was a bit odd. And I wasn't very good at all those things that people who've been to university are good.
All the small talk and socialising.
Socialising, yeah. and presentations and, you know, all
yeah.
that. I didn't have those sort of skills.
Well, most creatives aren't, are they? I did an interview the other day with Martin Jones, who runs the AR, and he confirmed lots of these things, that creatives are generally the worst in pitches. They're the worst at presenting.
Yes.
You know, for all who knows what reason, whether it's because they're closest to the work or because they're most creatives are introverts, they're not extroverts, they'd rather do than talk about
yeah.
it. You know, there's a
yeah.
bunch of things that make it, you know, that make it feel like your job isn't to get up and entertain, it's to actually do. So it was interesting having all that confirmed with, you know, Martin, who'd done like 1,000 pitches, that generally that's the case, you know. So you were going to go there. That was all in 1980, I think that was.
Which was it?
Very early, yeah. And obviously, for some reason, I presume you got cold feet or didn't do it, and then you went to BNP.
Yes, that's right.
What made you change your mind? Because it had made campaign, so it's quite a big...
They were.
Hard to change.
No, and I suddenly thought, oh, I'm going to be at this agency, and, oh, they wanted me to work.
It's going to be a problem at some point.
Who is that... art director? I think he was from Birmingham, quite short. He was a very good art director, actually.
From Birmingham? What, one of the early art directors they had there? I'm trying to think who that would be. Someone who did join Abbott Mead?
They were going to take him in as well. But it was like being forced on me.
Yeah.
And I thought, I don't like this.
God, that's a strange way of handling it, I would have thought, for David Abbott, but...
I can't remember this art director's name. How stupid.
Did he go to Abbott Mead or not?
I think he did. He was rather a good art director. But I had lunch with him and it was very uncomfortable.
David?
No.
Oh, the art director.
The art director. Anyway.
So you ended up thinking you didn't feel comfortable?
No, I don't want to do this, I thought.
Yeah.
And...
It's funny because I would have thought you're just his sort of writer. So then that's all.
Johnny, he's called. Johnny somebody, the art director.
Not the one who worked with Richard Foster, not John Horton.
No.
Johnny
anyway.
Foster. So awkwardly you back out of that. Presumably it's slightly awkward when it's appeared in campaign. Or did it
I can't remember. I think Derek was at BNP, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And he asked me to go in there and work with him. And I loved working with him, so I said, yeah, all right then.
How did you find BNP with their whole system of research and...
Oh, I thought it was ridiculous.
Did you?
Because,
again, you did lots of work. You made lots of work. I don't know how much you wrote, but you made a lot.
Yeah.
In a short time.
Yeah. It wasn't... I don't know. I didn't love it. And the creative director, John...
Webster.
Webster. Brilliant man. But quite odd in his way. I mean, I never felt close to him.
No.
And I just thought, well, I'll go and work... with Derek there. And it's interesting how some art directors couldn't be dealing with Derek. I mean, I remember when...
Some art directors at BNP couldn't deal with him.
No, I mean in the business, not just in there. For instance, I wanted at one point Derek to come into BNP, to BBH,
yeah,
and work with me. And I think he would have been brilliant because he'd be in a place where everyone was trying to do interesting work. And this is when Hegarty was getting to be more of a, you know, wanting to be the creative director and, you yeah. know, always in a meeting, basically. The only way we could work was have lunch together yeah. every day and do scripts over the, you know, plate of Italian.
And so that was kiboshed, was it? BBH, the idea of getting Derek.
Hegarty wouldn't hear of it.
Yeah, I can...
No, he's too weird, he's too this, he's too that. He would have been brilliant, I yeah. think, there. And he might have felt at home because, you know, John Bartle was always... I mean, I used to watch the clients in client meetings, particularly pitches. There'd be Nigel Bogle, who's, like, dazzlingly bright.
Yeah.
And... quite serious, you know, takes it all very seriously. And there's Hegarty dancing about in a sort of Paul Smith suit. And then there's John Bartle with a pipe in some terrible aubergine suit that
yeah.
God knows where he got it from. From Leeds, being like Mr. Reasonable.
Normal.
So yeah. it was a very good yeah. mix in that way.
So how did that come about? How did you go? So you go from BNP to BBH. I think that's right, that you went from BNP to BBH.
Did I?
I think yes. it was. So how did that come about? So you didn't know John Hegarty? Well,
that nearly didn't happen. That didn't, no. But he worked with Nigel Bogle. And I'd been
and
on that committee.
And you'd seen him and thought he was brilliant?
I thought he was brilliant. Any agency...
That had him.
Yeah. I said, any agency that he's going to start or is starting has got to be good news.
And had you just seen Nigel Bogle that once and he'd made such an impression? Or had you since seen
no,
him again?
No, I hadn't seen him since. No,
yeah,
I just thought
what an
he
amazing
was brilliant.
Impression. And,
well, it was
but
so
you,
unusual.
You knew Bartle, didn't you, from BNP? Did you
no.
work with him? Oh, you
didn't
no, know
I
didn't. Him either.
He did Cadbury's there.
Hmm.
But where they were coming from, BB&H, was...
TBWA.
Which was known by in the business as TweeBWA.
Yeah.
Because of John Hegarty's art direction, frankly. It was all very tasteful and
yeah.
know, artistic and all that, but didn't pack much of a punch. And interestingly, what was the name of the man who ran Campaign magazine?
Bernard Barnett.
Bernard. Bernard actually rang me up when it was announced that I was going to join BBH. And he said, Barbara, there's a John Hegarty ad... And there's a Barbara Notes ad, and that it's never going to work.
Oh,
don't
really?
Do this.
Yeah, so strange. Because
isn't that
they did brilliantly well, TBWA. They did a lot of really good ads, and they were Agency of the Year, I think, before they'd left. It's
yes.
funny that there was. I'd heard that thing about people calling them the TBWA, because I think they were very early in getting designers involved rather than, you know,
yes.
you look at. So it's interesting now, if you look back at some of the work from agencies of that period. Lots of it looks identical to each other because, you know, the headlines are always in the same place in bold fonts
yeah,
and blah,
yeah.
blah. So I think they were trying to get designers in to break it up in different ways and try different things. It's funny, they were sort of so castigated. It's amazing that the editor of Campaign would phone to warn you off. So
yeah.
so you didn't, you'd never met John before you joined.
No, but Derek had decided he was going back to CDP.
Right.
And he wanted me to go with him, and I didn't want to go back. And Dave Brown, who I always found quite over-serious, I suppose,
right.
Bloke, I never felt any kind of rapport with him. I'd met him a couple of times at,
right.
you know, DNAD things and that. And Derek said, oh, I've decided I'm going back there. And I said, well, I'm not coming. I don't want to go back there and I don't want to work with under Dave Brown because I like a lot of the stuff he does, but...
Yeah, he just didn't have a rapport.
No.
So
I thought, what am I going to do now? So I saw in Campaign that Nigel Bogle was one of the people about to start an agency. And... I thought any agency that Nigel Boker starts is going to be a good idea. So I sent her some communication, whatever it was at the time, saying to John Hegarty, saying, if you're looking for a writer, please put me on the list. I'd be interested. And he then rang me that day and said, you were already on the list. Let's have lunch. So we had lunch. And, I mean, we're very different. He's, you know, I'm left-wing, he's right-wing. We're not...
So presumably the lunch must have gone well, obviously.
Yes. He said, would you like some wine? I said, no, I don't drink at lunchtime, John. This is brownie points, I thought. He said, well, I'm not drinking at the moment because I'm in training for the run. What's it called?
The marathon. London Marathon.
He ran the marathon.
Did he really?
Oh, OK. Anyway, we chatted and he was saying, oh, I like that bit and I didn't like that. And he was obviously not hugely adventurous as an art director, and I don't think he is. But he's he has self-confidence on a level I've never encountered in anybody. His mother was... Jerry Judge went to the same school as him, grammar school in North London. And
Was he Hornsey?
Hegarty's mother was the secretary. Anyway, it was fruitful. I mean, what was marvellous, the first 4, maybe 5 years, what was marvellous is that everybody in the agency, and there weren't many of us, were all looking the same way. We all wanted to do well.
Yeah.
Because we wanted the agency to do well.
Did you have a period where it was a little bit scary and you thought, what have I done? Have we got, you know, there must have been a period where you didn't have business, or was that a matter of weeks before you won something?
Yeah, it was only weeks. I mean, I nearly didn't go because Hegarty wanted to give me less equity than Graham and Mike Cousins.
Right.
And I said, no. I mean, I had...
You'd done a lot of stuff by then, yeah.
Much more stuff in the book than they had at that time.
Yeah.
And I liked them very much, but it was because I was a woman.
You think?
Absolutely. Well, what else could it be? I mean, he wanted to work with me.
How did you... Because I'm always interested in when you move from partner to partner... All of a sudden, it's such a personal thing. You're thrust in a room together.
Yeah.
You don't really know each other. You don't know, you know.
Yeah,
it's a bit awkward, isn't it? Did that kind of work straight away? Did it take a bit of time?
Well, Derek was going back Yeah, it does. Derek was going back to... Did he go back to CDP in the end? I can't remember.
I think he was there twice. I think he left once over Frank Lowe asking him to carry his plant pots.
Asking him to carry what?
His plant pots. He resigned once over that. They were coming back from a shoot and Frank Lowe had some terracotta pots and he said, can you carry these for me? And he said, I'm resigned. And that was it. That was why he went once. I can't remember the second time. It's just so Derek.
It's very Derek, but it's also very stupid.
It is. There's another way of doing it, isn't it? Which is resign straight away. But I think that would impact Derek he obviously thinks really bad things of me, probably. Rather than just thinking he's asking me to carry his plant pots. So he resigned straight away. But he would bounce from job to job, obviously. So how did you... Obviously, I don't know, obviously, John, as much as you do. He is incredibly confident and... I would imagine that's tricky in a way, if because you're both sharing marks on paper and what about this and that. Yeah. And if someone is 100% radiating confidence, how do you get through that? I don't know whether that was tricky
was
or...
We were never very close. We were never sort of real mates like I was with Derek or Pete Harold, for instance. It just wasn't.
But you had an amazing run. So you did obviously Vorksprung, Dirk Technique, and all the films, which almost instantly was famous, wasn't it? In a way that things don't become as famous now because everybody's watching different channels and looking at their phones.
Yeah,
and
whereas
then it's like, I would almost guarantee that if we went back to comedy shows then, that would be spoofed and in mainstream comedy shows because it's a big, famous, new thing. And then Levi's. So what's the... How do you get briefed on Levi's? So Levi's at the time is a slightly tatty, oldie brand. It wasn't a glamorous brand.
People's dads were wearing them and doing the gardening in them. Yeah.
And they appoint BBH. I think they did two films first, the ones that Graham and Mike did, which was the rivets and stitching.
No, they were later.
Oh, were they later? So the first... Were they? Okay, so the first ones...
Well, there was Laundrette and there was the man in the bath.
Yeah, were they the first Levi's ads, TV ads that BBH did?
Yeah.
Oh, were they? Okay.
And I cast Nick Heyman. And the producer, the agency producer, he said, Hegarty's not going to like him, Barbara. He's too greasy, he's too street, he's too... And I said, but at the casting session, you know, we asked for... people who were 6 foot tall and, in reasonable
shape.
And they came in and there's like turrets is going up and down like that. And they were all like models. And in fact, Nick Kamen was a catwalk model.
Yeah.
But he came in and it was like instant. I said, well, you can send
him
the other
side. Well, he had an attitude
home.
Or something that you picked
he
up
He had
on.
Total attitude. He was wearing denim with silver bits on. I don't think I'm exaggerating, when he actually was actually wearing spurs.
Right.
As well.
Sort of thing, I can
And
imagine.
He sauntered in with this. And he had the absolute thing for appealing to young people, I thought, which was he had lots of front and lots of all this, but there was a vulnerability about him as well. Which was, and he was also good looking, you know, that helped.
Yeah.
But he was very street. We said, well, you've got the job, but you've got to lose half a stone and go to the gym 3 times a week before the shoot, which he did happily. So
what was the brief you were trying to answer? Because, so Levi's are a bit dowdy dad's jeans. You get the brief. Because again, I think at the time, it's very, very unusual to use old-fashioned music and to set things, I think, to set things in the past. You know, it's an unusual combination of... to set things back in time. You know, so you set...
Were they set back in time?
They felt 50s-ish or 60s-ish,
yes, exactly.
Stylistically. I don't know where they're supposed to be.
We wanted to put across that Levi's were the real thing, I suppose.
Authentic, yeah.
They were authentic. And for that to be authentic in those days, they had to be American.
Yeah.
But we wanted urban American, not...
Cowboys.
Rural, no cowboys. So I guess that was the sort of thinking.
And the music?
But we were very, very seriously helped by the director...
Roger Lyons,
who died, you know, he died tragically.
Cliff, yeah.
He was the lighting cameraman for Ridley Scott or someone.
Oh, was he?
I think.
Yeah.
And someone at the production company said, you know, this man wants to do this. And he gave it 200%. He really did. I mean, everything about the sort of styling and the backdrop for the laundrette thing, I had this whopping great Kodachrome, so longer than this room. I mean, it was extraordinary. His input was absolutely enormous.
So at what point did you think these are going to be very good? Did you see a cut and think, yep, these are good?
Well, I'd seen the rushes.
Well, they would have the impact. It's not so much that they're good, but they... culturally had a huge impact. Yeah.
Well, I came back to the agency and I'd seen the rushes that day and we'd shot some more. Nigel Bogle stopped me on the stairs and said, what's it like, Barbara? I said, Well, all I'll say, Nigel, is I think you're going to like it. And Nigel was somebody who, at some point, came into my office there and he shut the door and he said, Barbara, I want to talk to you. I want you and I to work on a system where the brief comes in and the brief is such and the system is such that only great ads come out the other end. I said, Nigel, you're talking about art here, and art comes out of chaos, actually. That's why in those days, I mean, lots of creative people went to the pub and got pissed and didn't work in the afternoon. But they did some very good work.
Did you do that or not?
No.
No. So what chaos were you working in? Because you seem to me not to be chaotic.
Well, having a full-time job and two small children was...
Yeah, there's your chaos there, I suppose, yeah.
It was a lovely story. I was at BNP and I was breastfeeding my daughter and she was teething. And I had had no sleep for about 3 nights and it was a pre-production meeting. And you know what that's like, cast of thousands. You have to be there. And I thought, well, I can't cancel it. If it had been a meeting with one person, I could have moved it, but... And I was at BNP, where the whole place was like living in a goldfish pond. You know, everything was glass.
Yeah.
The outside of... So the outside of the boardroom, you know, I'm practically in a trance. And Derek and I have got to do this pre-prod meeting. And I said, Derek, I've got to sleep. So I'm going to find somewhere. I've got to have an hour's sleep. So I won't make any sense.
Yeah.
And there was a big... board table in this room where I knew the pre-prod would take part. And so I got under it and laid on the floor and slept. And I kept thinking, I woke up a couple of times looking round to see if I'd be surrounded by feet.
Yeah.
but I wasn't. I got away with it. So I had to roll out to get up and, you know, go and straighten the hair out and what. And then we had the meeting. But that's the worst I'd ever been, a teething baby.
So it's interesting, the chaos theory, because I think people don't embrace... people always want to do what Nigel wants to do. They want to iron out any
control.
Creases.
Yes.
And, you know, even from having your antennae up and spotting things, which changes the brief, is a big part of it. And I don't know, I mean, I wasn't really a big pub guy. So,
no,
I didn't really.
Well,
I
you know,
really
the,
do that,
the pub at the end here was called the Sun and 13 Tampons.
Yeah. Oh, was it? Okay.
That's what it was called, and probably my relationship with people would have suffered from not going, being there every night, which because I was going home.
But so there must have been a point, and then obviously you did Dr. White's probably after Levi's, which again was a big deal at the time. It was like way that people spoke about that product.
Yeah. What happened with Dr. White's was very interesting because Derek and I had been approached by Peter Marsh to go...
To Alan Brady Marsh?
Was he called Peter Marsh? He was a sort of hooligan bloke. I mean,
a hooligan. He was an unusual... He was like a big flamboyant... Alan Brady Marsh.
White suits and all that. Yeah, him. So he asked Derek and I to go and have a drink with him at the Ritz. So we went and we heard about it. And Derek was easily taken in by this. I'm not sure about this bloke, you know. And we were going to have all sorts of creative freedom and, you know, and all that. And you think, I didn't really buy it. But what I did... What I was astounded by was when he said, oh, look, I've got to actually go. And a huge car, it should have been a Rolls Royce, I don't think it actually was. When you look out of the door at the Ritz, you can see the street, and it just went along like that and stopped. Peter Marsh walked in, got in it, and was driven off.
Wow.
Because he was, you know, how to spend the money, wasn't he? He was offering us a fortune and wanted, and I didn't. And I'm so glad I didn't, because they had a sanitary protection client there. And he, the reason we said no, well, we originally said yes, okay, sounds good.
Should we go to Alan Brady Marsh?
We were going to go.
Wow.
And we were going to be in a separate office and, you know, all that stuff. So we then got something to sign that had so many pages, and it was all legalese.
Right.
And we had to sign to say we'd agreed to all this. And I thought, I said to Derek, we can't sign this because we'd have to get it looked at legally ourselves, because I don't know what it means, do you? No. So we decided, we said, I'm sorry, the legalese, I can't be doing without. That's all cool. And I'm glad, because when we got Dr. White's, one of the clauses was that you couldn't, if you couldn't work on the same category of product after, if you left Alan Brady and Marsh.
Really?
Yeah, it was.
Oh, okay, so you wouldn't have been able to do that at BBH. That's strange.
No. Anyway, what happened at the BBH is that Jerry Judge sauntered into the office and said, well, you know, this is obviously one for you, Babs, because none of us know anything about periods. Here you go, here's the brief. So I looked at the brief, and I don't know what it said, but like so many briefs, it didn't say very much, really. Despite, you know, Nigel got onto this thing about how a brief should be this springboard from...
OK.
in your dreams, Nigel. Anyway, so John Hegarty went to Portugal to play tennis for 2 weeks. On holiday, you know, he was going on holiday. So I get this brief, and I did the campaign. Graham...
Watson.
Sorry?
Graham Watson.
Graham Watson.
Yeah.
When he was over last year, he said, I remember you doing those ads, and you just stuck them all on the wall. Hegarty wasn't in the building.
Right.
The man in women's underclothes... I sent a note round the agency asking for euphemisms for periods.
Right.
And I only got replies from men, because women don't use euphemisms when they're talking
that's
about
interesting.
Girl stuff. So
interesting.
And out of them came all that sort of those speech bubbles.
Yeah, those little...
Because there were people saying, I've fallen off my bicycle.
Yeah.
Because it's about the cycle. And there was even a French one... Les Anglais sont arrivés, the English arrive, and they had red coats, apparently.
Oh, God, really? Yeah.
I mean...
How funny.
What school did they go to? Anyway, I got all these things in, and so did the ad with the headline that said, call it what you like, a period's a bloody nuisance.
Yeah.
And it was all about how women actually approach a period, you know, just...
And that sort of language was very unusual at the time, to confront it head-on and use the word blood.
John Bartle was terrific. They did a lot of research with the ads. And one of the best things, responses I've ever had, was that some people said, this has to have been written by a woman.
Oh, really?
Which I was thrilled to, obviously... And it was either Ms. Magazine or Spare Rib. There were two very feminist magazines at the time. And none of us knew, but they ran a competition each month, I think it was, for what's your favourite ad in Spare Rib or Ms. this week. And they all picked...
Dr. White.
The Dr. White's ad, or the man in women's underclothes. And that's an interesting story. Stack took the photograph. So it was a very funny day. I think by this time I'm breastfeeding Luke. And, but I went in for the shoots and I finished the campaign. At one point with my mother-in-law coming in and taking Luke, you know, for a walk around the block while I had a meeting with somebody. Anyway... I've forgotten what I was about to tell you.
So the Miz voted them best
Yes, they voted the man in women's other clothes as their favourite ad. And it simply said, have you ever wondered how men would carry on if they had periods? And yeah. There's this gorgeous bloke. Again, I had real trouble with on casting with Hegarty because he said to me at the casting session, I said, well, that's it. He's the one. I mean, this absolutely gorgeous bloke walks in. And I said, you do realise this is about sanitary protection, don't you? You might not want your mates to see this. And he said, I'm on a trip around the world. I won't be here when it appears.
The model said this.
I don't care. The model, yeah. He was a good bloke.
Yeah.
And but the funny thing is, we had to get Janet Rager under clothes to fit him. So I was out in the most expensive women's underclothes shops in London, trying to buy things that were this thing. And they kept looking at me and saying, this is not for you then.
It's a bit baggy. Yeah.
I think they thought I was gay and I had some whopping great, woman partner. So it was very funny and we got it. And a couple of times, he did sort of, Stack, who was doing the photograph, would say, pum, pum. And he'd do that and then the bra would snap.
Right.
So we had to get two of everything. But on the shoot, John said, Barbara, we've got to have a word about this casting. Because I said, this is thrilling. This bloke is it, definitely. And it's the minute you walk in, you just know, don't you, what you're looking. So John said, Barbara, I don't think you understand the woman next door. Really? John, what do you mean? He said, well, you see, what the woman next door is looking for is the man next door. I said, John, have I got news for you? So, anyway, I thought, this is terrible. If we're going to have some awful bloke, the man next door. I mean, if they'd come in, they didn't have hairs on their legs. It was very funny because usually it's the other way round and it's men criticising women. But I'd say, no hairs on the legs, sorry, can't be doing that.
Well, all the shots in that campaign were very stylised, and I thought that was part of the vibe in that very stylised, almost surreal, weren't they?
Something. Yes. Stack was terrific.
Yeah.
And he and Hegarty were mates. And he spent 2 hours after the shoot, after I'd gone home, because I had babies to feed.
Yeah.
Stack convinced him that... In fact, so in this instance, I was right.
Okay.
And this gorgeous bloke was the one. And that Barbara might just be right that the man next door isn't what the women of England are looking for.
So how long after that? So did the relationship deteriorate a bit or did he get too busy or how did that... You went from there to Warren Brown, is that right?
Yeah. That was quite hard work. We didn't really...
What, you and Warren?
Yeah, I admired a lot of stuff he'd done.
Yeah.
And, but I don't know, it was too brash, too Australian, too.
Okay.
For me. Didn't work. The real crunch came when Hegarty was away, and as deputy, I was standing in, and... Who's the very nice account man who was married to Rita Clifton, Planner, Sarches? I can't remember his name. He's a really nice bloke.
Sure.
Anyway, he was the account director on Speedo. So he was the account director on that. So he came into my office and said, Bob, we've got a problem. Graham Watson and... Lovely writer. What's his name?
Bruce Crouch?
No. He didn't work there.
Chris Herring? Yeah.
Chris. Now, I'd met Chris before when I was at Dordain and waddling because I was pregnant with Daisy there. And I was supposed to leave by agreement. I was supposed to be gone by then. But Dawson was taking ill with diverticulitis and hospitalised. So he said, well, do you think you can waddle on a bit longer? I said, yeah, right. So I can't tell you, at 7 o'clock at night, there'd be people lining up outside your door, you know, to see the only person who's going to say yes or no. And I remember one night, it must have been 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, and it was Chris Herring, who was fairly new to writing. I think he'd come from the studio or somewhere. And or possibly a studio somewhere else. Anyway, he came in and he had a piece of Volkswagen copy. I thought, oh, God, this is going to be a nightmare. Stay tactful, Barbara. So I start reading through this. It was brilliant. And I said, well, Chris, I don't know what it is, but you've definitely got it. And I would transpose the last two sentences, but up to you. Off you go.
Yeah, brilliant.
So I knew he was good. So roll on a few years, and there he is. He's working with Graham Watson. And they've done this Speedo thing. And the clients bought it, but John Hegarty had done another commercial and insisted it was shown to the guy. And it was, you know, a da-da-da-da-da, you know. One of those, many that were done. And the client had said to the account man, I don't want this, because I want this one with this very good line cut through water.
Yeah.
So he said to me, well, Barbara, I want to call a meeting. We've got to sort this out because it's, like, embarrassing. The client is buying, has bought this.
Graham and Chris's one.
Graham, Chris's. So I said, OK, I'll come to the meeting. So they showed me the script, and it had a lot of chat down the side, a lot of, you know, words.
Yeah.
And I said, this is a really great idea, you know, underwater, people on bikes and all that. You don't need all the words. You've got a great end line. Cut to cut through water is terrific.
Yeah.
That's all you need. And you need this underwater cinematographer who's a nightmare, apparently, as a man, but brilliant at what he does. I said, I'll find out the name of him for you. And I did. The TV department knew this
guy. Yeah, Mike Portelli, I think that was.
Mike what?
Mike Portelli, was it? Who was an expert.
Might have been.
I can't.
Anyway, I think he was quite difficult to work with.
Right.
I was told. But the results were fabulous. Anyway, I said, well, I'd X all the words, keep that, and they'd show me, he'd show me the other Hegarty's commercial, sent, winged in
script,
from somewhere
yeah.
else, and said, I don't think it holds a candle to this. So the countman goes away thinking, oh, fuck, she's right, it is the better commercial.
Cut to cut through water is the better commercial.
Yeah. And Nigel and John Hegarty shared an office. They had back-to-back desks. And they called me up in the afternoon and said, John Hegarty's hopping mad about this. He wants his commercial made. And I said, well, what can I tell you? I was asked what I think is the best commercial, and I can tell you it's definitely Cut to Cut Through Water. With the right music or sound effects and this bloke running, it'll be terrific. And, of course, it won it. Gold's everywhere. It's actually in a book, it might be D&AD, with Hegarty as the creative director. I'm absolutely livid about it.
Right.
So
obviously that caused a problem, schism. So that caused a schism that you...
Real schism. Kind of... And John Bartle said to me, Barbara, are you sure you want to do this?
Yeah.
And I said, well, I could never be, like, politically correct and, you know, I can't do all that. And I said, if you're asking me which is the better commercial, I'm telling you it's this one, in my view. OK, so I went away, and, I mean, it was gunning for me from that moment, really.
That's a shame.
Yeah.
So you were still working together at that point, and then you stopped working together? You were...
No, he was drifting into being more the figurehead.
Yeah, okay.
And not actually doing,
So from then on, did it feel like a matter of time before you left?
Yeah.
What a shame. How long after did you leave?
I can't remember. They fired me and took back my equity.
Oh, wow.
I've got a feeling...
were you fired then?
Sorry?
I don't want to pry, but on what grounds were you fired?
I don't know. But they said, we want you to leave. But at this moment, I was in the throes of... My mother had died, and I was in the throes of breaking up with Roger.
Wow.
So I thought, now I'm not going to have a job. So the kids won't have a house. This is going to be tricky. Anyway, it was a very bad time. But what happened was they just asked me to go up to the office on their floor, the meeting room on their floor. And I went up, and it was John Bartle, who, at a Christmas party 2 years before, when dancing with me, like, you know, you do those things, he said, Barbara, I want you to know that I know that you have contributed more to the success of this agency than anyone whose name is not over the door.
Right.
And the Volkswagen client, who became the Audi client, said to me, the only thing that we'd be happier about is if your name was over the door as well. Because I'd worked with them at John Dordain for all those years. So they fired, and we had agreed up front that if anybody left, they had to give their shareholding back, their equity back.
Yeah.
Why did we ever agree to that? So they're millionaires and I'm not, which is kind of annoying.
So at the time, it's funny to hear you say, you thought, well, hang on, what, my kids, my house? Because obviously at that point, you could have walked into anywhere. You would have had a million job offers. I know sometimes, obviously, in that situation, you don't feel like that because it's a shock.
Lost my mother.
But obviously, at that time, I don't know what year that would be, late 80s? Obviously, you could have,
I think
you'd had an unbelievable track record, could have done whatever you wanted.
So it would have been 92.
Oh, well, is that late, was it? 92.
Yeah, I think so. I suspect if I had a father who was a lawyer, you know, I'd be a millionaire today. but I'm not. But, you know, I've had an interesting life and I've got two nice kids.
Yeah, absolutely. So from there...
I went to that...
You went to
agency.
KHBB, CME, KHBB, I can't
this
remember.
This looks like the Polish embassy, doesn't
yeah.
it? Yeah. But it was because Bruce Haynes was there.
Yeah, I know
thought
Bruce
was a
Haynes.
Nice break. And we did, Pete and I did do, I said I'd like Pete to come because Pete wasn't happy wherever he was. I can't remember what was going on.
Yeah, maybe White Collins.
And we didn't, we worked a bit together, but it was an agency that was, the clients were all leaving, basically.
Were they?
Yeah.
Got there too late.
It had been.
So obviously you did a lovely Pernod campaign.
That Pernod
which
campaign.
Is great. They could still be doing that. You know, there was a property there. It was like a
yeah. I was very pleased with that campaign.
So how did you feel starting there, having been at
and
BBH?
Then it all fell to bits.
Yeah.
Well, it was a shock.
It was a shock being out
of
the system.
Not
of
being with other people who felt
the same way. Yeah.
Yeah. Were concentrating on doing interesting ads, relevant ads.
Yeah.
I don't have any time for those people who are
just come up with wacky
just
stuff.
Doing it,
yeah.
You know, showing off. But relevant ads, but strikingly different. Radical but relevant.
So how long did that last, KHBB?
Well, I can't remember because I was going through
a couple of years, yeah.
And it was, it couldn't have been 2 years, I don't think.
You don't think it was that long?
It was something short like that.
Wasn't
2 years,
yeah.
Possibly.
Yeah.
And then Bruce Haynes went to Venezuela or somewhere. I've never been any good at managing my career. I was hopeless.
No.
Roger was very good when I was when we first met.
And well, he was better on that sort of stuff.
Go to Dordain and see Dawson. And he knew everybody in advertising, knew how it all worked, and he ought to have been working at Campaign, really.
Yeah.
But as I became more and more famous, he became, I think, more and more resentful.
It's tricky, yeah. You were the...
And if you look, if you go back, you know, 40 years, I mean, it was trickier, 50 years possibly, it was trickier for a man to be in that position. Yeah. And it was unusual that we both were doing the same job.
In the same
job.
Business. He was a writer too, wasn't he?
He was a writer as well, yeah.
So it's a tricky thing to... Well, is it more tricky for the man to be more famous than the woman who's a writer? Probably
more
not.
Famous?
Well, what I'm saying is you were a very well-known, very awarded writer, and he was a lesser-known, awarded writer. But is that more difficult? I mean, I know the answer is yes. Is that more difficult for the if it's a man?
For the man, it is.
Than if it's a woman, because but it seems unfair that that's obviously the case.
Well, it is unfair, but you know, I mean, there's not equality.
No.
It's a
particularly then.
Mm.
Yeah. What to say now other than thanks for coming. I mean, it's been unbelievable. I really appreciate your time, and it's been so interesting hearing that journey.
Yeah, it was good fun. I've had
so much there that I obviously didn't know, and I'm forever being asked to interview more women, and most of the time I say I'll interview as many women as possible as long as I love their work, and so you've been at the top of my list.
Well, I'm glad we actually got there in the end.
And we did get there, and you've stayed all this time. You've not stormed out, you've not scared me, like the fierce person that I've heard you are. You don't suffer fools, yet you've been here for 3 hours. So so it's been brilliant. So I really appreciate your time. It was just amazing.
And well, thank you for asking me.
It's been a pleasure.
It was a good thing.
It's excellent. Right, we're done. Thank you.